Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We regularly ask for feedback and requests for topics on this podcast, and one that keeps coming up, both on the podcast and in other interactions that we have, is how to protect your assets once you pass away, or at least make sure they get to the right person. Estate planning is one of those topics we tend to turn our minds to once we've taken care of our basic needs, and quite a few of our wants as well, and also as we get older for obvious reasons. But it also becomes a real issue for most people because almost everyone can name a family member or a friend or some scenario they're familiar with where issues over an estate or money have caused enormous distress and relationship breakdown. Certainly I can name many people where we've seen this happen, and it's just awful. So for this topic, I've gone to the best estate lawyer I know, who also does our personal family estate planning. This is Paul Evans of Mackinson de Peach, which is a Sydney-based law firm. Paul is highly trained in estate law. He lectures on this subject at New South Wales University. He's been named in Doyle's top three estate lawyers in New South Wales, which is a peer-reviewed and client-reviewed summary of the best of the best. So that's an incredible endorsement of his capabilities in these areas. And he's extremely well situated to help people understand how to tackle this really difficult subject and one that we all like to put off. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Gemma. I hope I can live up to that wonderful introduction.
I'm sure you can. So that's why you have it, right? So Paul, very few people really want to think about this. It's something that most of us try not to think about. Where do you suggest people start when it does come to mind?
Yeah, I agree. It's not a topic that is forefront of mind, and it's not very uplifting. What often triggers people to review their estate planning if they're going on a holiday, because everyone thinks the worst will happen when they're travelling overseas, when the likelihood is they're more likely to be hit by a bus on Pitt Street than
assuming
having
something
overseas if they live in Sydney. So I suppose it is an important topic to consider, because the ramifications of not having an up-to-date estate plan can be really quite trying and upsetting for people left behind. So it's important to give some thought to it, get it done, and then really put it away and keep it under regular review.
So let's say you've taken the first step in acknowledging that it's something you have to do, right? So you've decided to get this thought out of the bottom drawer and go, right, I'm going to get on to this. It is complex. It's not a simple thing. Some of us have very simple family scenarios, or perhaps have no family scenario to consider, but we have to consider to whom we'd like to bequeath our assets. Where do people start? How do you get the thought process going to go, what am I actually going to do once I start putting this in writing?
Yes, that's correct, Gemma. There are a lot of moving parts with this, because we do live in a complex society. Complexities can arise because somebody may be born overseas, so people from the UK and the US have to be careful with the impact of death duties being charged on their estates. Where people own assets in another country, they need to think about whether they need to have a separate estate plan covering those. We also live in an age where blended families are common, and they really have their own issues. People will maybe have children of a new relationship and children from a previous relationship. Trying to juggle who gets what and to keep everybody happy is always difficult. And also to look at possible claims that will come against the estate on death. So if somebody has an estranged child, for example, or somebody who has lived with them in their home as a member of their household. And bearing in mind also that each state has different legislation covering claims against the estate. So any comments I make have to be put into the context of that. I think the important starting point is, once you have decided to proceed and prepare an estate plan, is to instruct an appropriate lawyer who can assist with your plans. Everything in life is complex these days. Historically, a bone doctor would do hips, necks, shoulders, whatever. Now you'll have a doctor who will specialise in hips and knees, and the same really applies in the law, where It's not always appropriate to go to a generalist lawyer who will be doing your conveyancing. Another, maybe if you have a boundary dispute with your neighbour. Estate planning does need to be treated with care, because there are a lot of issues that can arise, and you need to instruct someone to assist you with the estate plan who is experienced in a wide variety of situations.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And your point about New South Wales, one of the reasons I emphasised that you were based in Sydney in the beginning was, you know, each state is different. I was so astonished when I learned that estate law is different in every state in Australia. That's got to create a world of pain for a lot of people, I imagine.
Yes, it does. And I must admit, I learnt something the other day that I wasn't aware of between the states. In New South Wales, if two people die together at the same time and you can't work out who died first and last, it's deemed that the younger person will survive. But in some states, that's not the case at all. So even at that level, there can be differences. But very broadly, if you're making a will, that will be recognised in each state. And the law is fairly similar between the states. But in the area of family provision, where people are disgruntled and not feeling they've had enough from your estate on death, that is really state-based.
Right.
So in New South Wales, for example, we have something called notional estate. So if you give an asset away before your death in the hope that you will then avoid your estate being challenged, the court can claw it back. But if you're living in Victoria or any of the other states or territories, there's no notional estate. So the day before you die, you could give your assets away and there won't be anything to claim against if someone does bring a claim.
Goodness. Okay, so we're going to, in a subsequent podcast, cover the issue of asset protection while you're alive. And I think that's a really important one to cover in that one. It's certainly when you consider issues like dementia and, aging relatives, giving assets away in inverted commas, often there's a question mark as to whether or not that was a genuine gift.
Is really a topic in itself, the whole thing of elder abuse. I suppose one thing that I should mention is that irrespective of which state you live in, you need to have a will, but you also need to have an enduring power of attorney that deals with your assets if you were to lose mental capacity. You need to have a document that gives people decision-making power over your health if you lose capacity. And increasingly, clients are concerned about having end-of-life decision documents in place because they don't want to be kept going forever and a day. Although I did hear of someone, it was in the news the other week, where I forget which country it was, but a lady had been kept in a coma for 27 years and has now recovered. So,
yeah, I heard that story also. My parents have joked about having DNR tattooed on their chests, which is do not resuscitate. That was saying that, you know, when the time comes, please don't resuscitate us. And apparently you don't want to be waiting for someone to make that decision.
You don't.
If it's tattooed on you, one's going to be confused.
Not.
I feel like that's probably going a bit far, but still. So one of the first things to consider is who your potential beneficiaries are. And you didn't mention it, but I've mentioned it many times. My brother has a disability, so he has Down syndrome. So I'm very familiar with the scenario where you have one beneficiary whose needs are really different to your other beneficiaries. My brother needs a completely different level of care and financial support to my sister and I, for example. So when people are coming to see a lawyer, as you say, you sort of bring this issue to front of mind, decide to deal with it, think about what you want to achieve. You do need to consider people you want to keep out of your will, your point about estranged children, those sorts of things, but also those people who need extra support.
That's perfectly true. Families with members who have a disability pose their own issues. And one area that needs to always be considered is how much you will be leaving the person with the disability, because you have to be careful that if someone's disabled, as a general rule, and I say as a general rule, they will be in receipt of a disability support pension, which is means tested. What you don't want is to leave them a small amount that exceeds the amount they can have, which then causes them to lose their benefit. But often these benefits are a passport to other benefits. So you get one benefit, you're then entitled to, I don't know, transport or whatever it might be. So in structuring a will for a disabled beneficiary, you need to bear in mind the amount they will be receiving and whether that will impact on their benefits. That can be an issue where you've got a more modest estate. I'm helping a client at the moment who she has quite a number of children, so the amount the daughter will be getting will be about 1.5 million, which may just be over the amount the daughter can receive without losing her benefits. So we're working with a financial advisor at the moment on how that can be structured. But where there is a disabled person involved, the will should always give the executor the option of including what is called a special disability trust. Those trusts were created by Centrelink some years back. They can either be created in a person's lifetime, so parents could establish one for their child in their lifetime, or it can be included as an option in the will. And the benefit of them is that the assets within the trust are exempt when Centrelink is calculating the means-tested benefit. But where you have a disabled person, you then need to consider carefully who you will appoint to look after the money. So it's important that you appoint as the trustee of that fund someone who is completely trustworthy, because a disabled person is not going to be able to whistleblow if things are being run incorrectly.
Yeah, the issue of vulnerability in that one's so significant. I'm sorry, I took you down the rabbit hole there on one particular issue, which I didn't intend to do. But one of the things that, so there's so many things to consider when people come to this. And I think many people think, well, I've only got a house, a car, and some superannuation or whatever it might be, you know, a limited number of assets. I don't need to give this too much thought. Or my personal situation is quite vanilla, right? You know, I have a spouse and two children, for example. Or worse, I am a single person and I have no potential beneficiaries, so I don't need to think about it, which is the one where it all goes a little bit wild. So starting with each of those scenarios, one of the critical things is the assets that you currently own, the manner in which you own them matters, doesn't it? Some things fall into your estate, some things don't. You need to know which ones do and don't and how you manage them.
Yeah, so as part of the estate planning process, it's important to identify what the client owns. So some assets you may think you own, for example, superannuation, but it's actually held outside your estate by the trustee of the fund. So if you have a self-managed super fund, you may be the trustee, but the asset is actually held outside your estate. Mm-hmm. If you have an industry fund, then the trustee is whichever it may be, MLC or whatever. So at the time of death, the trustee has a discretion as to how the benefit will be paid, although it is possible to complete nominations directing where the payment will flow on death. Assets such as family trusts, a lot of people will have them. They establish them in their lifetime. The will cannot direct what happens with the assets, but it can direct who will control the trust following death.
Right.
So you can nominate who will be the appointor. So the appointor is the individual who has the power to hire and fire the trustee. So I could have a family trust. I'm the appointor, and I then have a company in place as the trustee. So on my death, I need to make sure that I'm leaving the role of appointor and the shares in the trustee company to the same person. Because if they go in different directions, the appointor could remove the trustee and then have the control of the fund. Just coming back to that point, I think as a general rule, people will often be worth more dead than when they're alive because life insurance can be quite significant. And the reality is that it's important to think about what will happen and how to structure the will for those you're leaving behind. So traditionally, wills were fairly vanilla. You'd leave everything, mum died, everything went to dad and then to the children. And that's all very well, but it doesn't give the option of asset protection and the ability to income stream within the family. So the majority of my clients nowadays will complete wills that give each beneficiary the option of including or taking their inheritance through a testamentary trust that only takes effect on death.
Mm-hmm.
But going forward, for example, if someone has a wife or husband or spouse with minor children, if they leave everything to their surviving spouse outright, say there's $2 million in life insurance that falls into the estate, so the surviving spouse receives that. The income on that will then pass into their tax return. They will then be maintaining the dependent children from taxed income. If the will gives the surviving spouse the option of taking the assets through a trust, how it works is that the spouse will be the trustee, and every year he or she can then decide to pay the children's outgoings from the income of the fund, and very broadly, each child can receive up to $18,000 approximately dollars without any tax being paid. And at this stage, I haven't heard anything on the grapevine to indicate that if Labor gets in at the election, they will change that structure for testamentary trusts.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped a client some years ago, husband and wife, with their estate planning. Regrettably, the wife died suddenly from breast cancer. And whenever I see the husband, he said it's the best thing we ever did, because he has three children at private school. He's able to fund that basically from tax-free income.
It does make an extraordinary difference. I think, yeah, it's all so bleak and dreadful to talk about, but taking the financial pressure off you when things do go wrong, you know, when horrible things happen, to not be worried about your finances makes a big difference. And in addition to that, ensuring that it's structured in such a way that you don't have to worry about disputes makes such a difference. I think, you know, if you're grieving, to be dealing with the implications of additional potential beneficiaries and all those sorts of issues just sounds horrific and so hard. So there's so much to be said for getting prepared in advance. And testamentary trusts are so beneficial. This issue of having the children's income taxed at adult marginal tax rates, which is effectively what you've described, is so helpful for people. And what is described in the trust, I'm going to go from what you wrote in ours, is that effectively the income is used to provide for the care and accommodation of the kids, right?
That's correct.
So you're not spending it all on yourself. It's not like you go out and buy a Maserati with the income and, you know, the children are left in rags. It's the income that's distributed from that testamentary trust is designed to provide for the kids anyway. That's
yes.
what it's for, and that's
yeah.
why it's taxed
yeah.
differently.
They can also be, they're not just of benefit to people with young children. They can be useful for grandparents, because increasingly grandparents will help, if they can, with the payment of school fees. So between husband and wife, if they have grandchildren who are dependent, say the wife dies first, it's important to consider in her will having an optional testamentary trust, because the surviving spouse can then income stream and pay to the dependent grandchildren their school fees. They don't actually have to receive the money in their hand, but it can be applied for their benefit. So in effect, it gives the tax-effective distribution of income. But the other advantage of testamentary trusts is for asset protection. Because, and I say very broadly, say you have a parent dies, leaving their estate equally between their son and daughter. 5 years later, the daughter's relationship breaks down, whether it's de facto or married. Under the current law, very broadly, the court will look at the money in the testamentary trust as a resource of the relationship, but not an asset of the relationship that can be divided up. I mean, that can always change, and look, the court has power to do as it chooses. But at the very least, by having the testamentary trust, it's kept a separate balance sheet of what the assets are that have been inherited, rather than the assets coming into, say, a joint bank account, where they're then mixed and you can't tell who owned what.
The point you make is excellent, because I know very many people who say, you know, their great fear is that they'll die and then their spouse will leave it all to, often to the church is one that I hear quite a bit, you know, they'll leave it all to the church, or they'll remarry, you know, some fabulous young person who, you know, shows up in their life at a vulnerable time, and then all of the family assets are no longer family assets, you know, if that relationship breaks down subsequently, or they pass away. So this scenario where someone who is a couple who've been together for 50 years, one of them passes when they're both 70, the 72-year-old surviving spouse meets someone new and remarries, and then they pass away, and the new spouse inherits everything. That happens quite commonly, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, that's, I suppose, a tricky area of law, because if you've been married for a lengthy period of time, most likely the assets have been built up during the relationship. So the will can be structured that between spouses, they give each other what is known as a life interest, where they, the survivor gets the right to the income but not the capital. The difficulty with that is that the surviving spouse, if they want to sell the house or move or, you know, go on an expensive cruise, will have to get the consent of the trustee to deal with the money in that way. As a general rule, and I say as a general rule, the majority of clients who have been married only once or in a relationship only once will leave everything to the survivor and they will have control. Where that doesn't apply is where people are in a second relationship, where, say, you've got people in their 50s or 60s, they've come out of one relationship, going into another. They will want to, and they must ensure from the law, from a legal point of view, that they're making provision for their new spouse, but they will generally want the assets to then pass back to their own family. So, say, you've got spouse and spouse, and they've each got two children from a prior relationship. Usually they'll structure their will that on the death of the first, the survivor gets the right to use the assets for his or her life, but on subsequent death, they pass back to the first spouse's family. So that's called a life interest.
That's interesting, and I imagine it creates its own challenges.
It does indeed.
There are so many scenarios that are interesting for people to consider, and if nothing else, talking them through, here are your options, you know, these are the different scenarios you might like to consider could play out. One of the things I think is most important for people to recognize is using a very vanilla will or a very vanilla structure to distribute your assets may not reflect the complexity of your personal situation, and therefore when you're no longer around, right, no longer around to control everything, you have very limited ability to ensure that things work out the way you hope they would. You know, if you don't take steps to put a trust in place and so on, then effectively all hell could break loose.
But this is where it's important to speak to a lawyer who's experienced in the area. We've touched briefly on possible claims against the estate. There's no way that you can avoid a claim, because you can't, if someone has a right to bring a claim, then you can't remove their right to do so. So the will should be structured in such a way that mitigates as far as possible the claim. In most states and territories, when you're making a will, if you are not including someone who would be eligible to make a claim, so an estranged child, or even where under the will you're treating children differently, because maybe I've just helped someone who is leaving more to one daughter because she needs more help than her sister. So what should be done is a statement that is not included in the will, because the will becomes a public document. There's a separate behind the scenes statement that says, in my will of today's date, I have not included my son for whatever reason, I haven't distributed my estate equally for these particular reasons. The purpose of doing that is that following death, the statement can be used as evidence as to why you have structured the will in that place. And it can also be used to challenge a claim, because what can often happen is that people, when they're making the claim, they have a sort of a memory moment where they maybe conveniently forget particular facts, maybe the way that they treated their parent. So if the statement says, I haven't seen my child Bob for 20 years, and when I saw him last time, he told me I was a whatnot. Bob will not put that in his statement when he's making the claim, but the client's or the will maker's statement will have that, and in effect you can almost use it as a bit of blackmail, because you can say to Bob, well, have you forgotten this? This is what your parent has said.
Well, the other thing that I think people conveniently forget, and I've seen scenarios where this has happened, very difficult situation where a parent has helped one child to buy a home, for example. A person I know who has helped two of her children out of three to buy a home and not the third, and the third is not aware of that. So that strikes me as something that could be really problematic when you're looking at an estate situation. If the third child becomes aware that the other two kids got quite a lot of financial help quite a long time ago as well, so if you compound the impact of that, both of these scenarios were in Sydney. Sydney house prices went crazy, so you know the value of that assistance was very substantial. When considered, you know, you would definitely want to have some statement as to the impact of that and the intent around it.
Well, how that can be addressed, if you've made gifts or loans to one child and not to the others, those amounts can be brought into account under the will. Where significant sums are involved, so I suppose it's hard to say what is significant and what is insignificant, but maybe something over $50,000 if you're assisting a child in that way, is it's preferable to lend the money to the child, because if their relationship breaks down, your money then goes west. Whereas if the relationship breaks down, you can then bring the money back into your own name. And under the will can include provision that if at the date of my death I have made loans to my children, they're brought into account when calculating their percentage of the estate. And in effect, if one child's had a loan of $500 and one's had a loan of $200, there's an equalisation done at the time of death. If you're making gifts that are not by way of loan, so with smaller amounts, they can be brought into the account, just into account, simply by keeping a spreadsheet. But the will needs to say that I'm keeping a spreadsheet and I want those amounts to be deducted.
That's excellent, because that point about loans is really important. I would say the number one fear of wealthy parents is that if they still love and have good relationships with their kids, that their kids are going to get into rubbish relationships and fritter away all the assets. They either worry that their surviving spouse is going to get into a rubbish relationship and lose all the assets, or that their children will get into rubbish relationships and the assets will disappear. So loans are fabulous in that scenario too. Protect both the beneficiary and, you know, and the value of the estate, so that any new partner can enjoy the relationship without the burden of being considered a money grubber. Perhaps
one thing I should add before I forget: when preparing your will, it's important to consider who will be the executor, because on death your assets vest in the name of the executor once they've applied to the court in each state for what is called probate, which is an order that gives authority to the executor to transfer assets. Now, it's not always appropriate if you have, say, two children, for example, to appoint them. They may have a sour relationship, which will impede the administration of the estate. Or it may be that they won't honour your wishes and they will try and undo the will. And I have had this where, you know, following, I recommended to a client some years ago that she appointed one of the partners in this firm, because first of all, her son and daughter didn't get on. And there was also an issue where the grandmother, my client, had helped one of her grandsons to a greater extent than the other family members. And I had a concern that if she died leaving the son and daughter in place, that they would try and encourage the grandson, who was the son of one of the children, to maybe relinquish his gift. And sure enough, the lady died, and within a couple of months, this was what was happening. So the grandson was being put under pressure to give up his gift under the will and give it to his brothers and sisters. And by having the independent executor on board, I was able to ensure that the lady's wishes were followed through.
That's really fascinating, and that point about executor is probably not one that people give a huge amount of thought to. It's kind of like, who's available to do this job? But it is really important to find someone who's going to treat your wishes as the person making the will as paramount, rather than the many needs of those who become involved.
And you mentioned earlier people that don't have children. That quite often there you'll find that they will give gifts to charity, or they may give gifts to nephews and nieces. And often it can be an interesting area, because often people who don't have children may have numerous nephews and nieces. And the nephews and nieces are always hopeful that they will be the benefactors on aunt or uncle's death. And I remember years ago when I was working in London, I had a client who, she was in her 80s, she didn't have any children, she'd never married. And her, the most important thing in her lives were in her life were her dogs and cats. So her will left everything to animal charities. Well, at the funeral, the nephews and nieces came up to me and wanted to know what was in the will. So that also then brings into play the importance of an independent executor, because if you had a situation where you were leaving the estate maybe half to the nephews and nieces and half to a charity, and if you're appointing the family as your executors, it often happens that the executors will conveniently forget to pay the money to the charity.
Very conveniently.
And then they will just distribute it within the family. So the executor is an important role and should never be sort of underemphasised.
I think that's... everyone's probably got an example of that one too. So the one thing that is valuable about estate planning is almost everyone knows a scenario where this has played out really badly, and you don't want to be the person who creates that scenario, and you don't want to be the person on the receiving end of that scenario. It's just painful for everybody and awful and very expensive as well. One of the things that lets people down, and I find this really tragic, is that people can do the work, the mental work, to understand what their estate's going to look like, how it should be structured, get everything right from an intention perspective, but then their documentation lets them down. And I've certainly seen scenarios, the courts are full of superannuation cases like this, self-managed super funds, where a nomination has not been witnessed correctly, for example, because people downloaded one off the internet, didn't understand how it should work, or they, it was drafted incorrectly or something like that. Can you tell me a little bit about that, or tell people listening a little bit about that? Because I think it's absolutely imperative to understand that a professional matters in these situations.
It really comes back to the point I made earlier about instructing a lawyer who specialises in estate work. I can just give a number of examples, and I could be here all day, so I'll just give a couple. We had a will recently where I didn't draft it. It wasn't drafted in this firm. The will maker was in his 60s. He was divorced, had an adult daughter. He made a will dividing the estate between his adult daughter from his first relationship and his de facto wife. Now, what the solicitor drafting the will had not included was a declaration stating that if the gentleman married his de facto wife, that the will was not to be revoked, because they married suddenly on his deathbed. He had terminal cancer, so they married, and his will was revoked in part. And instead of his daughter receiving, I think it was half of the estate, she got a very much reduced proportion, because what happened was the gift of half the estate to the spouse was upheld because marriage didn't revoke the gift to her, but the gift of half of the estate to the daughter was revoked, and that then passed on the intestacy rules, which are different in each state. But in New South Wales, broadly, what happened was out of that 50%, the wife got the bulk of that, so she got the bulk of the estate. We had another one in country New South Wales where a will was meant to give an interest in a farming partnership, And the will ultimately had to be rectified because it had been so poorly drafted. The will did not reflect the intentions of the will maker, because he wanted his partnership interest to go to a particular person, and the will just did not give effect to that. So that cost, you know, a considerable amount of money that the estate, well, I think ultimately the lawyer had to bear it, but it caused a lot of angst along the way. So getting it right, I suppose, first of all, you have to reveal all of your assets to your solicitor. If you've had a child from a relationship that nobody knows about, you need to, if you've been on a bus in the 1960s going overland to England, and that I've had clients where they've had that, you need to reveal that to the solicitor, because you bet your bottom dollar that although you may think nobody knows about the child may well find out about your death. And it's interesting, with the internet these days, I've heard of a number of people who check regularly whether their parent is still alive, because they can do a search online, just type their name in, where they're estranged. They do that to find out whether the person is still living.
Goodness. Okay, so there's a lot to consider, and for those listening, I mean, I'm sure you've seen so many scenarios where this happens. It's funny that we all believe in our own situation, it will be clean and easy, even though we've seen 100 examples. Everyone's seen 100 examples where it was a disaster.
I think clients, and this is no criticism, they'll say to you, oh yes, my circumstances are very simple. Well, that's always a warning sign that they're not, because what a layperson may think is simple can be difficult to implement in the will. I'm just drafting a will at the moment for a client who's in a second relationship, owns a property with his new spouse, and we're having to put a mechanism into the will that she has the right to purchase his interest from superannuation monies, and we have to look at making sure that they're not going to be taxed as a result of coming into the estate. So there are a lot of moving parts. So I think if you don't remember anything else from what you're hearing, is to get appropriate advice from someone who is doing the work day in, day out.
One thing I want to, actually probably two things I want to cover off before we finish. One is I mentioned the home earlier. So most people, their largest asset is the family home. Certainly over the last 5 years, most people in Australia, family home worth quite a bit of money. And it may be the only asset you have. It is also the asset that's most likely to be held in joint names if you're married or bought it with somebody else. Can you talk me through the implications of joint versus tenants in common? Because I think a lot of people don't quite understand that from their estate perspective.
Yeah, so if you own an asset jointly with someone, there are two ways that you can own it. You can either own it as a joint tenant, so two people purchase a property together, or they purchase a parcel of shares together. So maybe it's Claire and Bob. So Claire dies first, everything, her interest in the asset passes automatically to Bob. So she could have a will that leaves her assets to a charity. And if the only asset that she owns is that jointly owned asset with Bob, the charity will get nothing because everything will go to Bob. The other way of owning an asset is where you own as a tenant in common. Now that can either be equally or unequally. It commonly will arise where people contribute a different amount. So if two people are purchasing a property and one is putting, say they're purchasing for $1 million, one's putting in 700,000, the other one 300,000. It may be that they will earn 30%, 70%. Coming back to that example, so if Claire and Bob are buying a property, she's putting in 70%, he's putting in 30%. On her death, in her will, she can say, I want my 70% to either go to Bob as the other owner or to the charity. That doesn't work if you have a joint tenancy. It's in most states, it's a pretty simple exercise to change the joint ownership. So if you own as joint tenants, you can change to tenants in common, but it will result in a 50-50 ownership, because a joint tenant is presumed to have contributed 50%, that you own it on a 50-50 basis. The reasons you might change the joint ownership is if you are completing one of the testamentary trust wills I mentioned earlier. Say you've got husband and wife, they own a house as joint tenants, say it's worth $5 million. By changing it to tenants in common, on the death of the first spouse, the survivor, well, under the way that I would draft the will, would have the option of bringing the value of that $2.5 million that's been inherited on the death of the first into the testamentary trust that will then give asset protection if he or she finds a younger model.
That term is great.
But if you are going to change the joint ownership, it has to be done in lifetime because it cannot be done post-death.
Right. And then the other thing, just to cover off very quickly, is intestacy. First of all, what does it mean and how does it play out?
Intestacy arises where there is no will or where the will only gives away part of the estate. So that example I gave earlier, where the will wasn't in contemplation of marriage, there was a partial intestacy there. Very, very broadly, in each state, there are different rules as to who will receive your assets if you die without a will. So in New South Wales, for example, if you die without a will, and you have two children, they will both inherit half of your estate. If they are under 18, if they're 14 and 16, they will inherit their money automatically at 18, so you won't be able to postpone the age at which they will inherit. If you die intestate, you cannot give specific gifts, so you may wish to give $1,000 to a charity or your golf clubs to your golfing buddy. But that won't happen because everything is dictated by the government formula in each state. There can also be complications where people have more than one spouse, because you can have a situation where people have multiple spouses. It sounds all very exhausting, but it does happen. You could have someone who has married maybe 5 years ago but has separated from that person, that married legal spouse. And they've then entered into a new relationship with someone else. And this can be same-sex or heterosexual. There's no difference now. And what can happen is that on intestacy, if you have more than one spouse, they're both entitled to the estate. They've then got to work out how that plays out. Intestacy is messy, especially where people have, where the estate may be passing to more distant relatives. We've just had an estate where part of the estate passed on intestacy to someone who was born in Latvia. And she'd been living here since, I think, 1940. But we've had a lengthy lot of investigations tracing, because someone died before her, their share passed on intestacy, and we had to trace her relatives in Latvia. And it's taken about 2 years to find them. So it's best to have a will that deals with the situation that even if you've got mum and dad and three kids, the will should always go a next level and say, well, if there's a complete calamity and everyone perishes at the same time, how the estate will be distributed.
Paul, thank you so much. It's such a complex area, and as I said, we're all guilty of pretending it's easy and simple, and then we start looking into it and think, no, we've seen plenty of scenarios where it isn't. Let's get on top of it. You've been incredibly generous with your insights today. Thank you. People will want to contact you. How do they contact you?
Well, I'm happy for people to contact me through our website or through you. So you'll have my details, email. I'm happy to speak with people on the phone. I think, look, the point I would actually make is don't be too alarmed by it all, because the reality is, I mean, I've dealt with these things on many occasions, so I'm familiar with how they can be structured. Mm-hmm. So I'm able to assist people with the complicated scenario and give them a plan that will be as watertight as possible and take the headache out of the whole process. So the point really is don't procrastinate with it, because it's better to have something in place that's 90% of what you want than nothing in place at all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We've gone to great lengths to make sure people understand it needs to be dealt with, but don't panic and think it's all too hard. That's not going to help
either. There is a solution.
Yeah, there are absolutely things you can do to get this right. Paul Evans from Mackinson DePeach, thank you so much today.
Thank you, Gemma.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it's been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.